Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Tonight, I'm proud to have as my guest Lady Michelle Renouf. Many of you are familiar with her name and her work. Lady Renouf lives in London and has for quite a few years been very visible in the Holocaust revisionist movement, particularly when helping revisionists when the law comes down on them. This list includes David Irving, Frederick Toben, Ernst Zundel, Robert Faurisson, Germar Rudolph, and Bishop Richard Williamson. She has appeared in televised debates with Norman Finkelstein and with a colleague, Dr. Nick Kohlestrom, among many others. She is also, though, a filmmaker and a former model and actress, but I will let her tell you about that. Her website, very interesting website, is www.tellingfilms.co.uk. So without further ado, hello and welcome to the Heretics Hour, Lady Renouf.
Hello, Carolyn, and hello, listeners. Very nice to be with you.
Well, it's truly wonderful to have you here, and I'm looking forward to this discussion we're going to have. I'd like you to tell us first about your filmmaking career and business, because many of our listeners may not be as familiar with that as they are with your more newsy Holocaust business. And also tell us where we can get hold of your films.
Well, Carolyn, if I could just explain about the website, actually, because the website is actually www.birobijan.co.uk, but the easier one to remember, that it's the same website, is www.jewishrepublic.com. Jewishrepublic, all one word, .com. It's the same as Birobijan, and later on perhaps we'll explain what that is and how significant I hope it will be, especially since my recent trip to speak with President Ahmadinejad in Iran. But coming back now to your question about my film work and so on, I suppose the best way to begin, so our listeners sort of get a bit of a handle on me, as it were, is that I have acted in television commercials internationally, commencing that kind of work when I was about 7 or 8. I was sort of discovered, as it were, walking around a shop with my mother, and people asked if I could represent some product or other, some Christmas promotion. And ever since that sort of totally accidental beginning to a lifelong career, I have acted in television commercials and print, well, all of my life up until the present, really. You might have seen me doing commercials for Capital One credit cards in America, and these kind of, well, all sorts of products, from chocolates to banks to everything. But the relevance of it is that through that kind of work, inadvertently, I came to understand that politics is very related to my particular expertise, in as much as it's about mispackaging and persuasion, selling sometimes a product that actually is not quite as it's labeled on the box. For instance, the war on Iraq, of course, is an extremely good example of how we were missold a concept. We didn't go in there to bring democracy or any such thing. We went in there to pillage and plunder as a proxy war for Israel's interests in this New World Order idea. And then, of course, when that mispackaging was blown and we were told that we'd been told lies, then another lie was invented to substitute. So really politics is very much governed and dictated. The creating and controlling of the narrative, as it were, is really based upon the same factors as in advertising. Some advertising is real and believable, and others is misleading and selling a dream. Not so bad if you sell a dream in our interests, but most of the politics that we are sold are really not in our interests, and that's where my support of the revisionists and their method enters into the picture.
Yes, so we're sold more like a nightmare, aren't we?
That's right. In fact, there was a very good program called The Power of Nightmares. I'd recommend our listeners to try and find, probably it's possible to find it on the internet. It was an extremely informative piece of film work.
Yes, I ran into that right when it came out, and I was busy trying to get people to pay attention to it at that time, mm-hmm. I recall. You mentioned your trip to Iran, very recent, and we are certainly wanting to talk about that. But before we get into that, I want to ask you a few questions. According to your history, as given to the public, in 2006, in November, while David Irving, while he was in prison in Austria, the far-right British National Party prevented you from addressing its Croydon branch on Irving's situation and saying that your presence would put the BNP in a bad light. Now, I'm interested in the way the BNP is having trouble keeping itself going and keeping itself together, I guess. What do you have to say about that?
Well, let's first of all start with David Irving. And how I came to know him was actually simply through the newspaper at the time in 2000, where he had taken Deborah Lipstadt to court in London at the High Court because she had accused him of being a Holocaust denier, an anti-Semite, and a racist, etc., etc., and he had taken her to court over that. And the only reason I went along, because in 2000, I had never heard of David Irving. I had taken no interest in what's called the Holocaust. I had really taken no interest particularly in World War II even. I had taken a great interest in Wagner and Judaism and written a monograph in 1997. But about World War II, Holocaust ideas and so on, they had not even entered my horizon after school, as it were. But he had said in the newspaper where he'd been quoted, which is unusual for being quoted correctly in the newspaper, as I say, there's also swindle speak, as I would call it, in reversing the advertising, branding, and promoting of ideas, even in our newspapers, as in advertising commercials. They had said that if he was a Jew, now he wouldn't be asking who pulled the trigger, but why. And I thought his question was very good, apropos the issue of Judaism and Jewish conduct. And so I went along to the High Court to hear what he had to say. And at that time, because they said he was Holocaust denier, which of course is a propaganda term, intended to make us believe that people who are doing normal revisionism of history, which is absolutely normal across the board, there should be no privileged veto on this. Actually, it gives the idea that people think that, or are trying to make out that nothing awful happened to Jews during the war. Holocaust denial, that concept, which of course no one suggests that things didn't happen and rather horrifically to Jews during the war. So I wasn't expecting much from Irving. Nevertheless, to me, he was asking the right question. So I went along and was very, very surprised to see that actually his argument in the court was objective, scientific, and rational, whereas the argument on the opposite side of the courtroom was surprisingly vague, imprecise, highly emotive, and giving nothing but sneers, insults, and ideas that were taboo to confront. So that's the bit about Irving. In 2006, of course, he was arrested and put into prison in Vienna. And from his cell, he was allowed to telephone me, and he said, please look after my family in this sudden emergency. And that was how I actually came to take over his website for that period in order to raise the funds necessary to keep his partner and their child functioning and so on, and generally sort of rescuing his copyrights and sort of looking after the interests of archive and history, really, whilst he was inactive.
Extremely noble and courageous of you. Your behavior for all of these people.
It's not personal with me, really. It is simply that I do believe that the unexamined life, as Socrates famously said, is not worth living. I do think that we have to hold truth as something sacred that we must uphold and wish to proceed to find in whatever course of action or whatever relationship we're in. This is the pleasure and the glory of our rights, really, under the classical tradition that we got from the Greeks.
Well, it's unfortunate that more don't see it that way, isn't it? Because that's...
Well, I actually think, Carolyn, that they would do, but for the fact that the cultural ethos does not promote this. I do believe that all people with any average intelligence, any common sense, I greatly value common sense, and I believe that people do want more than this sort of insulting idea that the common people only want bread and circuses. I believe that people... All people want more than that. They want something to look up to. They want something to admire. They want a metaphysical identity that makes them feel good and helps them relate to others. You know, you don't have to be a professor or a rocket scientist to wish for something more than the culture is presently giving us, which is the greed is good Judaic ethos.
I may be in danger of being overly admiring here, but I do want to say that you are a person who is not only beautiful physically, but you have a beautiful mind and a beautiful soul, and so that is why you are very special. And so,
Caroline, I am very lucky. All right. Caroline, I'm very lucky that in this revisionist movement, as it's called, I have actually come across people who are very good company. And, you know, our luck in life really is to come across, I think, the qualities of people that make us wish to have more qualities.
Absolutely.
You know, And I think it's my luck that I have come across some very good people who exemplify what I uphold most, which is the four classical inseparable virtues, namely temperance, which is the idea of measure and balance and harmony and so on, wisdom, but with, in the Greek sense of the classical tradition, of scientific attitude, and then, of course, justice that's unbiased, and the fourth one is courage, not vainglory courage, but courage prompted by empathy. But all of these four should not be separated. And fortunately, really, in a sense, due to, by accident, coming across Irving's case in the court and therefore bringing me into familiarity with the battle against the seemingly invincible, what I've come to term swindle speak, that we are surrounded with all the time, I have been lucky to come across very brave, very unbiased, very balanced, very reasonable people. And that's not to say that by any means they are, each and every one of them, perfect. I think we make a mistake when we try to seek people who are perfect or a concept that's perfect. But at least they head toward the combination of those virtues. And for me, that is pretty good. Well, you did ask me about the far right and the BNP. And just to say, as it happened, two nights ago, we had some Americans here having a conference on 9/11, reflecting on 9/11 and all of that swindle speak that we've been told about that. But the interesting thing is that Gilad Atzmon, who is the kind of Jew I like, actually, because he calls himself an ex-Jew, which means that he's had the intellectual courage to look at the identity of a Jew and say, that's not for me. Because I think you can be Jew-ish, Jew-ish. You don't have to be Jewish to be Jew-ish. And the definition of Jewishness is not particularly attractive from the point of view of the creedal anti-Gentile idea. But in any case, he said that he was criticizing as an Israeli-born person who has come out of Israel because he thinks it's a pirated area and he doesn't want to be party to it. He talked about all these friends of Israel, all the parties, the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, the Liberal Party, they all have friends of Israel as their sort of great promoters. And I said to him, well, don't forget the friends of Israel that are part of the BNP, because regrettably, the current leader of the British National Party is actually very pro-Israel. So he might as well be a friend of Israel in terms of his entire party, and that is why somebody wanted me to speak at one of their events, and he said, I may not speak. And then the newspapers got a hold of that and said that Renouf is too extreme even for the BNP, i.e., I will certainly criticize Israel. And unfortunately, Nick Griffin, who is the current leader of the BNP, does what many fools have tried to do in history. They have thought that they could coattail their way to power and the corridors of power and to overcome the predator by coattailing on the predator. And I find that quite lacking in virtue. I think the means are the end. I think we have to conduct ourselves as we mean to be when we reach our goal. Our goal is as actually getting there in the way in which we should wish to be when we arrive.
I don't think that works either. I don't know when that has ever worked.
Well, it hasn't, Carolyn. No. It hasn't, because it's not done him any good at all.
Yeah.
And anybody who wants to think that Israel is a nationalist ideal that we should all emulate is absolutely falling for the mispackaging of what is international Zionism. International Zionism is, of course, not a nationalist ideal. It's an anti-Gentile invisible army, as it's one of its Jewish Federation leaders described it. And so, unfortunately, the BNP is no more a representative of anything good for a nation than any of the other parties that we have in England, and actually typically elsewhere as well. We don't actually have a party that really any sensible person can vote for.
No, and thank you very much for saying all that. I do appreciate it. You mentioned Gilad Atzmon, and I forgot. Yes, he's in London now. Were you involved with that? Did you meet him, or are you just observing it?
Well, I wasn't part of it. Of course, I did ask a public question when I was there. But Gilad Atzmon, he's a chum of mine, really, which is rare because I don't have too many Jewish chums, or because I am highly critical of Judaism, not just Zionism. So he is a person that I respect because he is the rare person who can overcome the Jewish identity, which is highly vanity-oriented. People really don't wish to give it up. I think, unfortunately, Professor Norman Finkelstein is a person that I was terribly disappointed by. I thought he was a highly honest man, intellectually honest, until I had a debate by chance with him on a live radio program, and I discovered that he really puts his Jewish identity above what I would term his intellectual honesty, as opposed to Gilad Atzmon, who actually does respect his own intellectual honesty higher than a fantasy imposture.
I agree with you totally. I appreciate you saying that, too. Well, this should arouse maybe a little bit of comment. I think that Gilad, in my opinion, he has, in a sense, repudiated even being a Jew. You know,
yes,
he is a Jew, he's a Jew, but he's no longer, he doesn't identify, he doesn't want to identify as a Jew. And
he actually said something marvelous, I think will entertain you, Carolyn. He, when asked the night before last, was he a Jew, from someone in the audience, and he said, well, I'm one of two things from time to time. He said, I'm either an ex-Jew, or he said, I'm a self-hating Jew.
Yes.
You take it as you please, but I'm both of those things at different times. And I thought it was a wonderful statement of his, because I do think that the identity of a Jew is, whilst being highly motivating, which we can see in reality, nevertheless, it is also as infantile as I perceive Judaism to be. And I say that from the point of view of doing a postgraduate course at the University of London at Heythrop College on the psychology of religion. So it's not that I'm simply being insulting toward Judaism. I'm actually very interested in the subject of the psychology of religion.
Yes.
And my assessment is that I think it's sometimes you need to see bad behavior or a bad idea in order to know what it is that you think is a good idea. And for me, Judaism acts as a sort of mirror into which you can look and say, well, actually, that's not how I would like humanity to be at its best.
Yes.
And that's, for me, is what the purpose of Judaism is. And I think that Christianity and Islam actually reflect their founders' understanding that Judaism was not what we really want to be at our best. And at their best, both Christianity and Islam offer us a better vision of human conduct and aspiration, because neither of them wish to evaluate greed and vanity as a good thing. After all, Judaism is based on the concept of what I would call a bad father role model. You have a father God who favors one of his children for no particular reason. There's no merit particularly, that we are told in Judaism, for the election of a particular race, only that for some reason the God is a Jewish God and he has appointed his own Jewish people for whom he favors and treasures, and has said that the world is created for them and that the rest of humanity is there to serve them as their footstool. To me, that is so transparently vain and cannot be spiritual. And furthermore, you've got an idea of real estate for which these people are supposed to be having a headquarters in the world. In my view, Islam and Christianity saw the infantile nature of Judaism and gave us a better idea. Both of them do. To me, Christianity and Islam basically are dolphins as opposed to Judaism, which I regard as predatory. So that nowadays we have a multi-faith nonsense, a farce, where, like a mother, people are supposed to not see the difference between what I would regard as a dolphin and a shark. And that is, we're not allowed to draw attention to the fact that Judaism is anti-Gentile by the very definition of a Jew. A Jew is an anti-Gentile. And so that before you can have so-called anti-Semitism in the Old Testament, you have a concept of a world divided between Jews that are favored and the rest of the world, which is called Gentile, which is not favored. In fact, these people who have been creating and selling the idea of the Scofield Bible and the Vatican II revisionisms and so on, which are absolutely taking the teeth out of the warnings in Christianity that have been given us, so that we have some idea of why greed and vanity are not good things for humanity. They're infantile things. Sure, they are highly motivating, but they are not good for us. As I say, I am not an anti-Semite. First, I am pro-Semitic because I very much admire the backbone of the Palestinians and the voters of Hamas, who stand firm against the seemingly invincible lying, swindling of Israel and world Zionism. Therefore, it's got nothing to do with being a Semite or not being a Semite. So I object to being ever described as an anti-Semite.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, Lady Renouf, we have run out of time for our segment here, but we have not run out of time for our show, ladies and gentlemen. We're just going to take our break, and we'll be right back to continue with this discussion. Thank you.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
$500 million, that's the amount of money U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is allocating to Pakistan. It's part of that $7.5 billion development package approved by Congress just last year. Now, her next stop on this visit to the region is Kabul, where she's going to take part in an international donor conference aimed at getting money to win over Taliban fighters and try to lure them away from the battlefield. So there's a lot on the AFPAC front today. Well, to help me make sense of all this, I'm joined by Iraq war veteran and anti-war activist Michael Preisner from the Answer Coalition. Hi there, Michael. Good to see you. So first of all, let's look at Pakistan and the situation there. You know, this whole pledge of billions of dollars is part of an effort on the part of the United States to convince Pakistanis that U.S. interest in their country extends beyond the war on terror, beyond fighting Islamist militants. You know, but the interesting thing here is that when this thing first went through Congress, there were protests in Pakistan because of this very reason, because the Pakistani people were afraid that all this money would pretty much translate into America having a greater say in Pakistan's affairs. So given all that, what makes Clinton and other U.S. officials assume that Pakistan wants this U.S. aid?
Well, you know, it's interesting to point out that, you know, the United States is very, very good at mercilessly bombing a country and then offering rebuilding funds and offering aid funds after they've caused complete death and devastation and destruction. And that's the situation in Pakistan, a country that's routinely bombed by the United States, a country where, like you said, thousands of people have come out into the streets condemning the relationship that the U.S. has with Pakistan. But it's within that context that we have to view this aid, and the people of Pakistan who you mentioned are absolutely right. This deal has nothing to do with helping the people of Pakistan. It has everything to do with strengthening the client regime in Pakistan, which the United States sees as an essential partner in fighting a war in Afghanistan that the U.S. is currently losing.
Now let's talk about the donor conference that Hillary Clinton will attend alongside Afghan President Hamid Karzai. The issue that is really likely to gain traction here is this sort of effort to win over Taliban fighters, most likely with cash. Is that likely to happen? Are they going to put down arms in exchange for funds? What do you think?
Well, it does not look like the Taliban is in any position to negotiate with the United States right now, because the Taliban is winning the war very clearly. What this can be seen as is a move of desperation on behalf of the United States, who Hillary Clinton is going as that representative, saying that, you know, this goal in Afghanistan, the reason that we're told we must fight and die endlessly in Afghanistan is to drive the Taliban from any inch of political power, because if that was to happen, then another terrorist attack would be launched from the United States, from Afghanistan on the United States. That's the reason that we're giving. But on one hand, while we're being told we must fight and die endlessly to make sure the Taliban have no political power, we're seeing our representatives telling the Taliban that they'd like to put them on the payroll, offer them seats in the government if they just promise to allow the U.S. to carry out whatever business and military interest it has in that country. So this has to be viewed as a move of desperation, where the United States is really losing the war militarily. They know they cannot win militarily, so now they're going to these other classic colonial-type strategies of trying to win over the resistance fighters and put them on the payroll.
And Michael, when we think about that July 2011 date that was originally set for withdrawal, the rhetoric lately for most officials seems to be changing. Now we're calling it the drawdown date. You have Vice President Joe Biden recently questioning whether or not that's even realistic. What's going to happen in terms of that in really just 1 year from now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When Barack Obama announced last December, when he gave his speech announcing the escalation of the war in Afghanistan, many were looking at that speech as looking to an end for the war, a war that's gone on for almost 9 years now, a war that's been a tragedy.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I have my wonderful guest, Lady Michelle Renouf, with me. And she has been talking about the psychology of Judaism, because she's a student of religion. Please continue on with that, Lady Renouf, and I'm also interested in your connection with Bishop Williamson.
Well, Caroline, it's quite a sort of a story, really, and we have a certain victory in it, I'm pleased to say, a legal victory, as well as what I would call an ethical victory, because I believe that the arrest of Dr. Tobin, that your listeners may know about a year ago now, when he was on his way actually to America, I think he was going. But in any case, he was arrested under a European arrest warrant when he was in transit at Heathrow Airport.
Yes.
And the concept was that they wanted Britain to harmonize, is the word, with occupied German law. Of course, it's Israeli drafted law, where there is a sort of privileged veto on what may be revised in history in the normal way and what is taboo and may never be queried. And that's the issue on World War II. It is taught in schools even that you may not use normal historical debate and rational argument when teaching what is called the Holocaust. Now, I'm just quoting from the teaching guidelines there. So Tobin was arrested because he had a website in Australia, which is a revisionist website. Now, I believe that the Tobin case was the first rung, as it were, of a ladder, which is a very typical Judaic operation. And we have that actually from one of the founding Zionists, Max Nordau, in one of his speeches in 1903, 11 years before World War II. He was already describing how they were going to use the rungs of the ladder. So, yes, I'm so sorry, World War I, yes. How the strategy is as per the rungs of a ladder leading upward and upward, so that their prey do not see where they're heading, but each step they take takes them toward their goal. In this case, what he was talking about was to achieve Palestine, which is what I would call the biggest advertising logo on the planet, which is Jerusalem, so that you can hoodwink people with your imposture, that somehow having achieved a profiteering come true, in effect it looks like it's a prophecy come true. And that is most certainly what has happened in the criminal pirating of Palestine. So using this strategy, which is very much to be found in the concepts of the Talmud, which is the law books by which Jews understand their Torah, which Christians call the Old Testament. And, of course, the Mossad get their motto from the Talmud in the same way that it is make war by way of deception. That comes from the Talmud. So does Max Nordau's concepts. So that whilst many Jews believe themselves in opposition, in some cases, to Zionism, nevertheless, the founding creed of both Zionism and Judaism is the same mission, and that should not be overlooked. To me, the only difference between Zionism and Judaism is that the Orthodox Neturei Karta rabbis and the smarter Jews have not forgotten the basic tenet of the Talmud, which is not to show your hand. And unfortunately, for all Jews of the world, the manifestation of Israel is the Old Testament made manifest, and it reveals the hand and the idea of the anti-Gentile mission. So that is basically the difference.
How clever of you that is.
Well, that is the basic mission there, and it's just a different way of approaching it, just the same as Bolshevism of the Soviet Union and Zionism were two sides of the same coin. It's world domination, a new world order, as we hear it even from Gordon Brown and all sorts of people in the corridors of power talk about the new world order, and the new world order is international Zionism. So just coming back to the Tobin case and the concept of the strategy, the Judaic, not just the Zionist, but the Judaic strategy of make war by way of deception. There is this sort of rungs of the ladder way of approaching a goal. Now, I see that strategy in the process that leads from Tobin's arrest by European arrest warrant up to the Vatican. And if I could just explain how I see those rungs, because Tobin was arrested. The concept was that they are used to Dr. Tobin fighting his cases morally. He is a moralist, and like many people, they have learned in childhood from the idea of the Solomon parable that if you tell the judge the truth in a courtroom, somehow you are expecting the judge will see your truth and he will grant you the right result. But actually, this is an infantile idea. We all tend to fall for it, I'm afraid, because we wish that life were like that. But actually, in courtrooms, the lawyers deal only with legal precedent, penal codes, and legalese, in fact. They don't deal with moralistic, they cannot deal with things beyond the laws as they are given to us. So it is really about manipulating the laws in a court of law, nothing to do really with justice in an ethical sense. It's a matter, as we all know, of having the right kind of lawyer who can manipulate the laws as they stand and the precedents as they stand. So a moralizer in a courtroom is out of water, really, even though we wish that's what international law is about. In fact, it simply isn't. So what I call our predator, the New World Order operators who control and operate invisibly in our occupied nations and our laws and our governments and our media and so on, knew that Tobin would conduct his defense in a moralistic way rather than in a nitty-gritty legal way because he's not a lawyer. Mm-hmm. So they
thought... And isn't this the way that all of the revisionists have conducted... I mean, this is the way the revisionist trials have gone, haven't they? As trying to...
Yes, Carolyn, That's right, Carolyn, and that is why the only really successful lawyer there has been was the one that took the appeal for David Irving in 2006, and that's Dr. Herbert Schaller. And in fact, Dr. Herbert Schaller, I learned a great deal from Dr. Herbert Schaller because I interviewed him for my film sequence to Jailing Opinions, which will be Jailing the Lawyers, which will come out at the end of this year. And I had gone to Dr. Schaller in Vienna to interview him for this film to explain to me how he was so successful in getting David Irving out of prison 2 years earlier when David had actually rather foolishly taken a left-wing lawyer in hopes that somehow or other people would not notice that he was a right-wing historian. And that lawyer, left-wing lawyer, actually helped him not at all. And he wound up in prison there. So Dr. Schaller was very successful, and indirectly, without realizing it, I had learnt from Dr. Schaller what I've just been explaining to you, in a sense, how the laws work and how it's possible to defeat our predator by operating in the manner in which these laws can be defeated, i.e. you can prove that the laws are vague and imprecise. So when I heard that my colleague Dr. Tobin had been arrested, 6 months after that, after this, no connection between Dr. Schaller and Tobin at all. But when I heard he had been arrested, I said to him, look, I think it's possible that we could potentially win your case if you will allow me to conduct it in my way. And he agreed, which was lucky. And so I was able to get a defense team together and conduct it, to sort of mobilize it in the same way as I had understood how it's possible to win in a court of law via Dr. Schaller, though I stress he had nothing to do with either of the cases. Now, the second rung of the ladder was that our predator thought that he could use Dr. Tobin's extradition to Germany as a means of getting a legal precedence by which it would have been made by the back door a precedent by which other people who were querying World War II as it is officially and given privileged veto on any other discussion on source critical looking into this particular account of history, like the Bishop Williamson's, for example, that he would then automatically go straight to prison like Tobin had, and there would be no hearing in the public gaze, and there would be therefore a harmonizing with the German so-called legal system, and it would bypass English law, where you get a proper trial, as opposed to the non-chance that you do in Germany, because they already have decided that anyone who queries the official account of what is termed, in a religious term, the Holocaust, and any querying of the Third Reich and what one may or may not see in terms of its account of conduct, they are already going to be imprisoned. And even their lawyers in Germany and Austria and actually 10 countries in Europe, even the lawyer dare not bring into to defend his case, his client in court, any evidential exhibits, i.e. of a source critical nature, of a revisionist nature, even forensic proofs and so on, because if he does, he too will be prosecuted and put into prison. So what was needed was to get the third rung of this ladder, i.e. Bishop Williamson, who had recently been saying historical truth should go by evidence and not emotion, therefore going against the privileged veto of so-called Holocaust laws in these countries where you are imprisoned, they needed a way to actually get an English bishop into that prison. The only way to do that would be to create a legal precedent in English law, which would therefore bypass his right to a proper high court case in England, and he would go straight away with nobody knowing anything much about what was going on, straight into prison. So we actually, by winning that case for Tobin and stopping him from being extradited for 5 years into a German jail, meant that the legal precedent was not established. We were able to prove that the European arrest warrant was vague and imprecise, and in fact it is vague and imprecise as the law it is based upon in Germany. I had learnt from Dr. Schaller that the law, the Holocaust denial law as it's called, is actually, in that law there is no actual description of what is supposed to be the alleged mass murder weapon. It's not actually described. So people can be imprisoned for up to 20 years for querying and wishing to have a scientific evidence for this so-called mass homicidal mass murder weapon, even though it is not defined properly and clearly in the law.
Well, Lady Renouf, is that the part that is considered to be, what is that, a self-evident? That's not the words they use.
That's right. It's Offenkundigkeit, they call it. German pronunciation is not very good, but it means manifestly obvious. They say that what is called the Holocaust, and after all, it is a religious term. Holocaust means sacrificial burnt offering. That's why I'm interested in the term and in the concept from a religious, psychologically religious point of view, because something that has been termed in a religious sense, i.e. a sacrificial burnt offering, which is in a covenantal bargain with the Jewish God, which in this instance gets them the promised land, as they describe Palestine, to me is an extremely case of imposture from the point of view of the concept, because the reason that Israel has been created, it's actually based in this idea of a covenantal bargain. And that is why the pogrom during World War II against the Jews in Germany and elsewhere has been termed by Zionists as a Holocaust, a sacrificial burnt offering, because it complies with this concept that Jews were sacrificed to their God, and in return the God, the assimilated Jews, that is, the ones that are regarded as unholy because they have assimilated and lost their idea of Jewishness, therefore they were sacrificed and God rewarded them with their promised land. I mean, this is so obviously, first of all, it's infantile in terms of its argument. It's as a spiritual idea, it's clearly infantile. And secondly, it's an idea that really I think religious people should be examining from the right of even accepting this term. Terms are very important because our predator has won over the creating and the controlling of the narrative, because he has this facility like advertising commercials for coining definitions, yes, that actually are mispackaging.
Yes. Can we get back to Bishop Williamson, which many people are very interested in? Where does he stand now? What is his condition?
Well, so the luck was, Carolyn, because we succeeded with this victory over the vague and imprecise law. This actually prevented the Bishop Williamson, when he was expelled outrageously from his seminary in Argentina by the pressures of the ADL and so on. He was actually safe when he got back home to Britain, because there was no such legal precedent that actually would have sent him immediately to Mannheim prison for 5 years. So he is safe here. But there's enormous pressure on his brotherhood, what's called the SXPX. These are the traditional Roman Catholics who do not agree with the Vatican II alteration of the understanding of the hermeneutics of Christianity, whereby in the Vatican II Council in the 1960s, the warnings of Christ against what he termed the rabbinical deceivers, the Jewish deceivers, have been taken out. And so, basically, Bishop Richard Williamson is really the last Christian, actually, the last Christian bishop at all. Because the pressure on the SXPX, that's the Society for St. Pius X, which was founded by Archbishop Lefebvre, who objected to, had made the Judaic revisionism of Christianity in the Vatican II. There is such enormous pressure on the leader, who is called Bishop Fellay, that Bishop Fellay would rather sacrifice his honorable bishop in order for the SXPX not to be dishonored publicly by the Judaic influenced, the pro-Zionist influenced media, because the Vatican, the Pope, has been willing to take back into the fold of the Vatican this brotherhood. But the ADL forces and so on, who are pressuring the Vatican on this matter, wish to, what I would call, make the SXPX kosher, i.e. take out the warnings that have been given to Christianity, through Christianity to the world, i.e. to know the difference between a shark and a dolphin, as I would put it. And now we are to allow sharks to swim in our waters, quite as if we should not notice their difference with dolphins. So,
very good. Lady Renouf, we're running out of time. We don't have too much time left in our segment here. What is Bishop Williamson's status now? Would you say?
Well, you're very tolerant, Carolyn. You're very tolerant, Carolyn, because I do go off at great tangents to try and explain things. And so I do rather take a long time to answer your straightforward questions. But yes, he's safe and well. In London, he lives not too far from me, and I. But he does have hanging over him a legal case in Germany that he has to answer, and his position now is to decide whether he will go to Germany to be present at the appeal, because the appeal is imposing a very heavy fine on him for simply saying that he will not change his view until a scientific proof can be brought to him which is capable of changing his view from what was established for him in the 1980s in the trials in Canada conducted by Ernst Zundel and Professor Robert Forresson and experts in extermination engineering that was with Fred Leuchter. There was a great deal of cross-examination on witness stands that since that time have been absolutely made illegal, so that the normal behavior of history for revisionism is now jettisoned, and now we have a privileged veto on history.
Yes, well, so if he does go to Germany for this trial, is he in danger by doing so, or what are the options?
Well, yes, it's possible for him to be endangered, because if he were to breathe another word of his own skepticism, which will be very difficult for our American audience to fathom, because just his opinion, expressing not even his opinion, but expressing the findings of the cross-examinations of so-called eyewitnesses to this homicidal mass murder weapon, as opposed, of course, to gas chambers, which were for disinfecting clothing, which no one denies. He only has to express what were the findings in that courtroom, and he would go immediately to prison. And if his lawyer were to defend him in doing that, that lawyer would also go straight to prison. So he's not going to get a fair trial in Germany at all. We don't hope.
So why would he go? Why would he go?
Well, exactly, Caroline. It is at first. His superior general, Bishop Fillet, told him he was under no circumstances to go to Germany, not to protect him, but to make sure that his opinions are not raised again, which will give bad publicity to the SXPX, which is what the Fillet is most concerned about. He's concerned about, to my mind, the wrong thing. He's not concerned.
So he probably won't go. Is that correct? I mean, he probably won't go. What benefit would it be to him to go and testify?
Well, Well, that was what we all felt in the first instance. We felt that it was unwise for him to go there because there was every risk that he would be imprisoned just simply for any mistake he might have made in expressing an opinion. People are imprisoned there for their opinions that go contrary to the privilege veto. So we are waiting to see whether he will want to raise the awareness of the public.
Okay, all right.
To the situation.
By going.
Or not.
Yes, and sort of sacrificing himself. All right, well, we've come to the end of the hour. Lady Renouf, I'm so appreciative of your very wise counsel here and your interesting conversation. And I welcome you to continue on for another hour so we can go into your Iran visit. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Is that all right, Lady Renouf?
Well, with pleasure. I'm sorry I take so long to answer a question.
No, that's fine. That's fine. We get lots of things we didn't know existed here. So, all right. Well, good night, ladies and gentlemen. And please join us again next week.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.